Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, the debate over the Central American Free Trade Agreement is heating up, and while there is greater split in political and corporate elites than there was in the 90s NAFTA debate, media cheerleading for the so-called free trade legislation is still a given. We'll talk to Chris Slevin, the Deputy Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, about CAFTA. Also on the program, New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman's new book is a bestseller, despite a writing style somehow simultaneously tortured and goofy. But does the argument of the world is flat, a brief history of the 21st century, hold any water? We'll hear from Amitabh Pal, managing editor of the Progressive magazine, on that score. But first, as usual, a quick look back at recent press.
The debate's over. Globe is warming. So said the front page of USA Today on June 13th, declaring that the scientific consensus on global warming, that it's real and is exacerbated by human activity, is undeniable. The paper noted that politicians and even much of corporate America are now accepting global warming as reality. All too often, the media present a sort of on-the-one-hand, on-the-other-hand approach to climate change that gives unscientific corporate flacks a seat at the table to legitimize their position. So, kudos to USA Today. That is, until 2 days later, on June 15th, where on the editorial page of the paper, readers saw, you guessed it, a debate over global warming. The paper's editorial supported its news report, while on the other side, we got the perspective of Republican Senator James Inhofe, whose piece was headlined, "Don't Give In to Global Alarmists Whose Intents Are Questionable." Inhofe argued that there was a lack of scientific consensus to justify capping carbon emissions. You have to wonder how reporters feel when their work is undermined by their own editorial sections.
New developments at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The New York Times reported June 18th that, contrary to his previous claims, CPB's new Republican chair, Kenneth Tomlinson, had, in fact, been in talks with a White House official about creating CPB's ombudsman office while that official was still on her job at the White House. Mary Andrews subsequently joined CPB as senior advisor to the president. In one email obtained by the Times, Tomlinson explains to then-CPB President Kathleen Cox that Andrews, fresh from the Bush White House, quote, will be worth her weight in gold, close quote. You'll recall that this whole brouhaha is supposedly based on research showing that the program Now with Bill Moyers was unacceptably politically slanted. Turns out that research, which was commissioned by Tomlinson without the CPB board's knowledge and which has yet to be made public, was conducted by a guy named Fred Mann, who works at the National Journalism Center, a group that trains and finds jobs for conservative journalists, and boasts such alumni as Ann Coulter. No surprise, then, that the professionalism of the research is, well, problematic. Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan got hold of some of the raw data and referred to it in a recent little-noticed Senate speech. According to Dorgan, when Republican Senator Chuck Hagel appeared on Moyers' show, the study categorized him as a liberal, evidently because he raised some question about White House policy. A segment about financial waste at the Pentagon was classified as anti-defense. In general, Dorgan said, the data was unusual and strange. Quote, we have all of these sheets that describe the guests, and it says anti-Bush, anti-Bush, pro-Bush, anti-Bush. It appears to me to be not so much an evaluation of is this slanted, is it liberal, does it have an agenda? It is the evaluation of is this program critical of the president, close quote. But in case anyone still wondered how much credence to lend to Tomlinson's professed concern with fairness, and no, this is not a joke, in a May 20th NPR interview, Baltimore Sun reporter David Folkenflik recalled what he had heard from two former CPB officials. At one closed board meeting, Tomlinson suggested bringing in Britt Hume from Fox News Channel to talk to public broadcasting folks about how to create balanced news programs.
Time Magazine's June 27th issue is dedicated to stories about China. One of those pieces profiled a familiar American company making its way into China. That's Walmart. It's hard not to notice the rah-rah tone of the piece. Walmart is staging a revolution in China, says Time, in part by, quote, spreading a management style that many of its young Chinese employees find liberating, close quote. But beyond the cheering, there are some factual problems. When Time mentions criticisms of Walmart, it reports that, quote, it's the buy side, not the sell side, that gets the headlines back home, close quote. In other words, what Time is saying is that here in the U.S., the debate is over lost manufacturing jobs, not Walmart's in-store policies. But that's just false. Walmart faces several lawsuits for its employment practices. That's the sell side, to use Time terminology, including a massive class action lawsuit filed on behalf of women who've worked at the store since 1998. Time quotes one company official saying that low-wage manufacturing makes sense for U.S. consumers. Without it, quote, it would mean $180 blue jeans. Is that what Americans want? Close quote. Time lets that bogus argument slide without rebuttal, but Walmart critics aren't granted the same free ride. When a spokesman for Sweatshop Watch is quoted saying that Walmart benefits from the push for low-wage labor around the globe, Time rushes to the company's defense by arguing that, quote, that may be less true now than it was 20 years ago, close quote. The evidence? Many of Walmart's suppliers, says Time, are operating in countries like Taiwan and Hong Kong and had left U.S. workers long ago. It's unclear how that undermines the point that Walmart drives the race to the bottom in the global economy. In fact, that sounds more like evidence that it's doing just that. But if you're worried about sweatshop labor, Time tells us not to. Quote, Walmart says it's trying to export its American-style standards and ethics to China's manufacturing sector, too, close quote. What a relief.
There are certain political pundits who only claim to be progressive when they're promoting a conservative position. Fox News contributor Susan Estrich is a good example. Estrich wrote a June 21st Christian Science Monitor column that was a gushing tribute to her Fox News employer. Estrich took pains to explain that she is a liberal, a feminist, and a Democrat. So readers might not know that Estrich is the sort of liberal who once begged, let Clinton be the centrist Clinton, and the sort of feminist who criticized Arianna Huffington for running for governor instead of staying home with her kids, and the sort of Democrat who worked for Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's transition team. The Monitor column looks like a response to the charge made by Democratic Party Chair Howard Dean and others that Fox News is a propaganda outlet for the Republican Party. But Estrich ignores the bias charge and instead offers a non sequitur. Quote, three times as many people watch Fox every day as watch CNN, close quote. That's an odd comeback. It's also not right. Recent Nielsen ratings show that Fox actually has not three times, but less than twice as many viewers as CNN, and that's not even adjusting for viewing habits. But while sidestepping the fundamental charge of bias, Estrich does spend a lot of time discussing why she loves Fox News. It seems they pay her very well, and when she has disagreements with young Fox producers, she gets her way by threatening to go over their heads to the network president, Roger Ailes. Well, that is a good network for Susan Estrich.
Finally, James Weinstein, leading progressive-era historian and the founder and publisher of the magazine In These Times, died on June 16th in Chicago at the age of 78. Weinstein's work and that of his magazine, which lives on, have always been highly valued here at Counterspin. As we were thinking of how to remember him here on the show, we came across this tribute to Weinstein by fellow Chicagoan and progressive Studs Terkel. We decided we couldn't say it better. Terkel said, quote, Jim Weinstein was a shining example of a truly independent journalist. In his own way, he was in the tradition of George Seldes and I.F. Stone and Lincoln Steffens, muckraking journalists who challenged the received wisdom. He always asked why and who is behind what and where are the bodies buried. More than ever, we need journalists such as Jim, who insisted that we must think things through, that we must remember the past in order to understand the present and prepare for the future. Close quote. Jim Weinstein will be missed.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
The debate over the Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA, is making its way onto television and newspaper editorial pages in a rather one-sided way. As the Chicago Tribune points out on June 16th, quote, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has churned out three dozen radio and television news segments since the first of the year that promote a controversial trade agreement with Central America, which is opposed by labor unions, the sugar industry, and many members of Congress, including some Republicans, close quote. The public interest group Public Citizen has been tracking the CAFTA debate closely, particularly on newspaper editorial pages. Chris Slevin is the deputy director of Public Citizen's Global Trade Watch. He joins us now from Washington, D.C. to talk about CAFTA. Welcome to Counterspin, Chris Slevin.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Well, as the Chicago Tribune reported, the Department of Agriculture is putting out video news releases and audio news releases, otherwise known as fake news stories, on CAFTA. What can you tell us about these radio and television stories, if you
Sure. I'm sure a lot of your listeners are aware of the USDA has what I think they call a Broadcast Media and Technology Center, where they produce essentially the content for television and radio stations all around the country. They call the video ones video news releases, and they have audio news releases. And they have a $3 million budget, and they've proven very effective and quickly churning out content to stations all around the country. And if you look on their website, their mission says that it's nonpartisan, but if you have ever listened or seen one of the pieces, you realize that that's just not the case. It's blatantly partisan, usually uses White House talking points. So, as you mentioned, the Chicago Tribune recently exposed the USDA's VNRs, a story by Andy Martin just this past week, so that the USDA has produced 36 radio and TV segments that promote CAFTA, and the story says it took some snippets from some of the VNRs, and directly quoting the Secretary of Agriculture, Mike Johanns, who has been going around the country saying that CAFTA should be an easy decision for members of Congress right now. And if anyone that's followed the CAFTA debate, it's not an easy decision for a lot of members of Congress right now. There's been 10 years of NAFTA, which this agreement is based on, that has a lot of people being critical. And so it's not an easy decision. And you have Johanns on these USDA-produced segments saying, I can't imagine how any senator or House member from ag country could stand up and vote against CAFTA. It makes no sense to me. It's voting against our producers. So it's not exactly nonpartisan.
Well, leaving the media issue aside for a moment, how does today's CAFTA debate differ politically from the NAFTA debate of the mid-90s?
Well, there's been nothing like NAFTA, and it was an experiment that it had a very long debate that started with George H.W. Bush administration and continued into the Clinton White House, and it was based primarily on a theory of how international commercial agreements should be written. And the difference between then, where it was still a very contentious debate, and now is that we have 10, now 11 years of results with NAFTA, and we can see that it has been a job exporting agreement. It hasn't brought the sustainable development and stability to Mexico that promoters said that it would. It's driven more than a million small farmers off the land because of corn that's just not let them compete. It's driven down wages in Mexico by 20%. So there's just not the argument there that proponents of NAFTA had a dozen years ago. Right now, there's more of a foreign policy argument being made by the administration, and that this is something that's needed for, you know, peace and stability in the region, and something that they're relating it to national security right now.
Back in the mid-90s, corporate and political elites pretty much lined up behind NAFTA. That's changed a little bit today, hasn't it, with CAFTA?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, there are high-profile supporters of NAFTA who have taken a more critical view towards this CAFTA. Joseph Stiglitz, someone who's been, you know, well-documented in the press of taking a more thoughtful approach to the way that we write trade policy. Reardon Ruette is the director of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, very establishment. Someone who is an ardent NAFTA supporter is basically been touring the country and giving briefings to members of Congress on this CAFTA saying, it's not working. We can't do this again.
I was thinking also along the lines of the sugar industry, and as far as partisan lines, there seem to be more Republicans and Democrats, too,
sure,
that are doubtful about CAFTA.
Well, during NAFTA, I mean, the first Bush administration negotiated NAFTA, and the Clinton administration essentially inherited it and sold it to Congress. So there was a relatively new administration and Democratic members of Congress that wanted to stand behind their president and support this. And you had Republicans in the House who were basically just listening to business, and they went along with it, too. So despite more of a divide in the general public there in Congress, when it got down to it, it was pushed through pretty easily by the Clinton White House. Right now, it's a different calculus in Congress, and the Republicans have a majority, obviously, but there's, as you mentioned, sugar. Sugar imports are allowed under this, and there's been some controversy over that. And states where there is cane sugar, like Florida, Louisiana, and Texas, have elected officials who are a bit hesitant to go along with this. And added on top of that, sugar beets, which are all throughout the Midwest, all the way out to Idaho and parts of Oregon, many Republican districts that would otherwise be supportive of just about any piece on the Bush administration agenda are hesitant about that because they're hearing from small farmers who produce sugar beets. And so it is a different calculus here, and you have largely a Democratic base that's united in opposing CAFTA on its merits and seeing that, you know, 10 years of NAFTA haven't added up, and that people seeing that the trade deficit is on the front page more and more, and that CAFTA represents more of the same policy.
Well, in the 1990s, FAIR studies showed that the media, news stories, and particularly editorials were heavily slanted in favor of NAFTA. What is Public Citizen finding today in coverage of the CAFTA debate now?
Still, it's like 10 years of NAFTA didn't happen. We don't expect editorial boards to come out against CAFTA. What's been really surprising is just the fervor with which editorial boards are still promoting this kind of trade policy. There has been an onslaught of pro-CAFTA editorials in the last couple of months since the CAFTA debate has really heated up. In about mid-April, which was around the time when Congress first held hearings on CAFTA, the Office of U.S. Trade Representative, the arm of the administration that oversees trade policy, released an editorial board memo. And 2 weeks later, actually on April 25th, a Monday, pro-CAFTA editorials appeared in Orlando, the Miami Herald, the Houston Chronicle, Los Angeles Times, San Antonio Express News, the Washington Post, Seattle Times, USA Today, and the Kansas City Star, and repeated in various other papers through the rest of that week. So for anyone like Public Citizen that follows this issue very closely, it ran like a coordinated campaign between the administration and editorial boards, and most of these editorials took directly from the administration's talking points that CAFTA will create more jobs in the U.S., will usher in democracy and stability in Central America, improve worker rights abroad, and that just generally that free trade equals prosperity, and that the critics are isolationists.
We've been speaking with Chris Slevin, Deputy Director of Public Citizen's Global Trade Watch. You can read Public Citizen's work on CAFTA online at www.citizen.org. Chris Slevin, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Books high on bombast and low on complexity are published all the time, certainly, but not all dealing with an issue as important and controversial as globalization, and not all by people who enjoy a perch at the country's most prominent newspaper. For those reasons, it's worth taking a look at the latest from New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman. The book, The World is Flat, A Brief History of the 21st Century, is being discussed and will have some influence, like it or not. So what is Friedman trying to say, and what kind of a job does he do? Amitabh Pal joins us now by telephone from Madison, Wisconsin. He's the managing editor of the Progressive magazine, and his review of Friedman's book appears in the July issue. Welcome to Counterspin, Amitabh Pal.
Thank you so much, Janine.
Well, the title provides this dominant image, which is already popping up in political conversation. The world is getting flatter. What on earth does Friedman mean by that?
That's his odd interpretation of what one of his Indian corporate buddies, Nandan Nilekani, who's the chief executive of an Indian computer firm, Infosys, told him, that the global playing field is becoming leveled. And from that, Friedman gets the world is flat. I mean, which is kind of an odd way of interpreting what Nandan Nilekani told him. But what he means by this is that due to technological changes such as the internet, due to the adoption of free market capitalism by pretty much almost all countries around the world, and due to innovation of all sorts, a couple of billion people have entered the workforce in India and China who weren't there previously. And because of this, opened up enormous opportunities for people in the developing world. I mean, he cites outsourcing, which has been in the news in the past year or two. You know, Indian call center operators answering phone calls for American credit card companies, etc. And then, of course, there's this entire movement of manufacturing jobs to China. So that's the reason that, you know, he gets his title. And let me sort of just offer a couple of words in his defense. The thesis is not completely wrong. What he does is, and the problem is that he overstates it so much that it becomes almost a joke. But it's not absolutely off the mark.
Now, is the argument that there is a more level economic playing field in general around the world due to these technological and sort of corporate policy changes?
Yes. The argument is that it has become so much easier for educated Indians and Chinese, and these are his two major examples, to enter the workforce than was even imaginable 5 to 7 years ago. And this is true to a certain extent. Again, you know, in the large metropolitan centers in India, upper middle class English-speaking youth are now able to do computer software work. They're able to do call center work. But this is such a limited phenomenon, and Friedman enthuses about this as if, you know, the entire Indian workforce is able to take advantage of all these recent innovations, while, you know, 70% of India lives in the villages and, you know, is dependent on agriculture and has no way at all of taking advantage of any of these sort of changes.
So the problem is in the extrapolation from his examples to a broader picture. Well, a persuasive argument cites potential criticisms and responds to them, but it sounds from your review as though Friedman doesn't really engage some of the important issues or questions that might challenge his line on this.
Yes. Another problem with Friedman I've always felt is that, and ever since The Lexus and the Olive Tree, his book about 6 years ago, which dealt with the same subject, that he's really unable to tackle globalization in all its complexities. So, for example, he doesn't at all go into the question of the patenting of drugs, of life-saving medications. In India, this was such a big issue just a few months ago because India is the major center of production of generic drugs, including AIDS drugs. And in order to comply with World Trade Organization rules, the Indian Parliament just recently, a few months ago, passed tougher patent protections, which will mean that these drugs will not be available at affordable prices, not only for Indians, but for people throughout the developing world. There's no mention of this at all, for example. There's no mention of currency trading. A lot of these countries have their currencies fully convertible and fully tradable by currency speculators, with the major exceptions of India and China. This was one of the major reasons for the Asian economic crisis in the late 90s, which hit Thailand, Malaysia, a number of countries at one go. Again, India and China were spared that because their currencies aren't fully convertible. No discussion of this at all. No discussion of the patenting of agricultural seeds, of life forms, nothing at all about this.
It sounds as though the cultural impact also of globalization is in Friedman's eyes, always seen as positive. At one point, he states, the wretched of the earth want to go to Disneyland, with no evident awareness of any ethnocentrism in that point of view. And in talking about cultural impact, let's talk a little about India briefly, because that is Friedman's one of his main illustrations.
Sure.
And you have visited some of the very sites that for him are models of the flat world, those call centers. If you could briefly tell us the conclusions you came to that differ from what Friedman's trying to say.
You know, Friedman sees no problem at all in these call center jobs. While what they entail is, you know, the adoption of fake American or British accents and identities. So people are giving up their Indian names and accents and adopting fake American accents and identities. And it'd be almost like a joke if it wasn't for the fact that they're almost forced to, otherwise they don't have a job, basically. I mean, and that's what their companies insist on, that they basically pretend to be somebody who they aren't. And Friedman says, no problem, you know, they all love this. While it may be true for a small percentage of people, but a lot of them are actually not very happy about this. Second problem is that they have to work the night shift because of the difference in time between India and the United States or Britain. Friedman says, no problem. You know, he told Terry Gross on Fresh Air that the night shift fits in very well with the Indian day. I'm not sure how, if you're working at night and having to sleep during the daytime. I mean, only Friedman can understand as to how that fits in very well with the Indian day.
Well, let me ask you how you imagine The Lexus and the Olive Tree was a bestseller. This is already a bestseller. Maybe it's early, but how are you imagining this is all going to be received by the media? Should we be looking forward to talk about the flat world?
I would certainly think so. You know, as I said in my, I reviewed The Lexus and the Olive Tree, and I said, you know, Friedman is a pooba of American journalism. I mean, you know, he's so influential on so many levels. Yes, the book is doing so well, which is sad, you know, because he sort of, I think he, another problem with his book is that he condescends to the average reader. He feels that they will not be able to grasp complex subjects like globalization unless he writes with, you know, this very sort of catchphrasey style and with these anecdotes, with these silly sort of simplistic anecdotes. And unfortunately, that seems to work because the book was number one on the bestseller list and is still on the bestseller list. And you're right. I mean, I think it'll, you know, the problem is that people will now increasingly be talking in the years to come of, you know, how the world has become flat and how it's benefiting people all around the globe.
That underscores the importance of directing people to other sources of information on those same issues, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I don't want to sort of toot my own horn, but certainly, you know, the Progressive, The Nation, all these progressive media outlets, you know, offer critiques of globalization that aren't there in the mainstream media. Oddly enough, even a person like Joseph Stiglitz, because I think he wants to be published in the New York Times again, he has a great book out, former World Bank chief economist, Nobel Prize winner in economics, had a great book out a few years ago, Globalization and Its Discontents, where he offers a great critique of the IMF, though not so much of the World Bank. And he had a review of Friedman in the New York Times, and he was so kind to the book. I mean, he had mild criticisms to offer. I feel that the reason is that he felt that, you know, if he criticized the New York Times columnist too strongly, that, you know, he may not be asked to ever write again for them.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Amitabh Pal, managing editor of The Progressive magazine. You can find his article on the new Tom Friedman book in The Progressive's July issue. Thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Well, thank you so much, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of this program, or if you'd like to hear previous programs, you can do that at FAIR's website. It's www.fair.org. And that website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.